Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, Wendell Corey stars on The Adventures of Steve Canyon, and Clem McCarthy has a call of the 1946 Kentucky Derby. But first, Colleen Hardin shares the horse who had his picture in the paper on Stories Are for Fun, as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Let's listen to Stories Are for Fun, brought to you transcribed from Radio Television, the University of Texas, in cooperation with the Austin Junior League and the Austin Public Schools. Today's story takes place in the largest city in the whole United States, a city with millions of people and automobiles and trucks. It has rivers and big bridges, and the way it's located, you can cross a bridge and be in another state. One look at your map and you know we're talking about
New York City. And whether you've ever been there or not, the chances are you've heard about it on radio or seen pictures of it in books and movies or on television.
But even if you've been to New York, you probably didn't meet the interesting character who is the hero of our story. He's the horse who had his picture in the paper. That's the name of our story, and here to tell you all about the hero's adventures is storyteller Colleen Hardin.
The city of New York is so crowded with tall buildings that you must tilt your head back and look straight up to see the sky. So, of course, there isn't room for green fields or fat red barns. Nearly everybody lives upstairs, even the horses. In one of the buildings lived a horse named Joey. Joey was a contented horse. He liked his stall, which was sunny, with a window to look out of. He liked working for Mr. Pulaski, who sold fruits and vegetables to city people. Joey liked the folks he met as he pulled the vegetable cart about the city streets, and he was fond of his friend, the Percheron. A Percheron is a big horse who hauls heavy loads. But getting back to Joey, he was as contented as a horse can be, until the day Brownie moved into the right-hand stall next to his. Brownie was a police horse, and he never let anyone forget it. He was very proud of being on the police force, and as he was very, very proud because he once had his picture in the paper, he treated the other horses coolly because they were ordinary fellows who pulled carts like Joy or hauled big wagons like the Percheron. He himself carried a police sergeant on his back. "It isn't just any horse who gets on the force," he told Joy haughtily. "We're picked for our brains, you know. Besides, I'm a hero. That's why I had my picture in the paper." "Is that good?" asked Joey, who had lived a sheltered life. "Of course it's good," said Brownie. "It got my sergeant a promotion, so now he has more money in the bank, and I have more apples with my lunch." Joey didn't care about the apples. Mr. Pulaski gave him all the apples he wanted. But he knew Mr. Pulaski had 6 children at home who were always needing new shoes, and that sometimes he worried about money. "A vegetable cart is no gold mine," Joey often heard him say. Now Joey wished he could have his picture in the paper. Maybe then Mr. Pulaski would get a promotion, too. He thought and he thought, but he couldn't decide how to go about it. "How do you get to be a hero?" he asked Brownie timidly. "Save a man's life, like me," Brownie answered. "Did you rescue him from a burning building?" asked Joey. "Not at all," snorted Brownie. "I saved his life by not stepping on him. When a crowd pushed him, he fell under my feet, and I stood as still as a statue, the way they taught me in school." The Percheron, who was listening, nearly strangled on his oats. "Think of the lives I've saved," he whispered to Joy. "Thousands and thousands. Why, the city is filled with people I haven't stepped on." But Joy didn't laugh. He just went on wondering how he could be a hero and get his picture in the paper. Whenever he saw a crowd, he trotted toward it, hoping somebody would fall under his feet. But Mr. Pulaski always pulled him back to the curb again. And though he stood quiet as a statue while Mr. Pulaski sold the vegetables, that didn't make him a hero. It just brought him pats on the nose and an extra carrot or two. Then one day he thought his chance had come. Mr. Pulaski was selling a cauliflower to a woman in front of an apartment house when suddenly a little boy just learning to walk came down the apartment house steps ahead of his nurse and wobbled into the busy street where cars and trucks were whizzing by. The nurse called to the little boy, but he didn't stop. The lady pinching the cauliflower was too busy to notice, and Mr. Pulaski was too busy with the lady. But Joey saw, and quick as a flash, he reached out and caught the little boy by the seat of his bright blue sunsuit. Now I'm a hero, he thought to himself, and surely my picture will be in the paper. But the little boy began to cry, and the nurse came shrieking, help! And the lady dropped the cauliflower and said, I do believe your horse bit that child. Mr. Pulaski hadn't been watching, so he couldn't explain that Joey was only rescuing the little boy from the cars and trucks. Mr. Pulaski apologized to the nurse, and on the way down the street he scolded Joey. A vegetable cart isn't a gold mine, he said crossly, and now you have lost me a customer. And he didn't even give Joey an apple with his lunch. Joey was quite downhearted, and he asked the percherin that night, how am I to get my picture in the paper? Join a circus, snapped the percheron impatiently. He was fond of Joey, but he believed that Brownie was putting foolish ideas into Joey's head. Join a circus, Joey thought to himself. Why, yes, circus horses do get their pictures in the paper. I could learn to walk on my hind legs and do tricks. But when he practiced walking on his hind legs in the stall, he frightened the man who was bringing the oats. And after he tried to bow and kneel on one leg like circus horses do, he ached so badly that he limped as he pulled the cart. So he had to give up the idea of becoming a circus performer. Then one day, this wanting to help Mr. Pulaski got Joey into trouble. It was a pleasant morning in June. Joey was jogging along, enjoying the sunshine, while Mr. Pulaski, from the front seat of the cart, was singing out, strawberries, strawberries, nice, fresh strawberries. A lady called from the upstairs window of a house, and Mr. Pulaski, stopping the cart, climbed up the steps to sell her two boxes of berries. He left Joey standing still as a statue. But just as Mr. Pulaski was counting his change in the hall, Joey heard a sound that made his ears stand straight on his head. It was the exciting sound of trumpets and drums and marching feet. A parade, thought Joey. He knew about parades. Brownie had often told him that the horse who led one was bound to have his picture in the paper. Lifting his feet smartly and trailing the reins to one side, off he trotted in the direction of the music. He reached the corner just as the marchers reached it, too. The crowds watching were too surprised to stop him. Even the policemen were too late. Before they knew it, Joy was there at the head of the line, ready to lead the parade up the avenue. The only trouble was that he had taken a left turn while the parade was trying to turn right. There he was in the way of everybody. The fife players stopped so suddenly that the buglers stepped on their heels. The drummers stepped on the heels of the buglers, and the men who were only marching stepped on the heels of the drummers. The whole parade came to a standstill. When Mr. Pulaski ran at the corner, the policeman was holding Joey by the bridle. The crowd was laughing, and the paraders were very angry. It was a dreadful moment. Mr. Pulaski explained that Joey meant no harm, so the policeman let them go, and the parade started up again. But Mr. Pulaski seemed so frightened that Joey realized he had made a terrible mistake. Whatever has got into you, Joey? Asked Mr. Pulaski. A vegetable cart is no gold mine. But you'll make me poorer than I am if you don't behave. Then what will happen to my six children? Poor Joey, he felt very sad. I'll never be a hero, and I'll never amount to anything, Joey confided to the percheron. I'm just an ordinary city horse with no talent. It's too bad for Mr. Pulaski. You're a good fellow, Joey, said the percheron. Just cheer up and get that nonsense out of your head about newspaper pictures. Do your duty and everything will be all right. So Joey made the effort to be cheerful and obedient, and Mr. Pulaski didn't have to scold him again. But things weren't going too well with the vegetable cart. The vegetables and fruit wilted from the heat, and no one in the city would buy them. But Mr. Pulaski's six children ate just as much as ever and needed as many pairs of shoes. One morning, earlier than usual, Mr. Pulaski came into the stable and took Joey out to the cart. We're going to New Jersey, Joey, he said, as he fastened the harness and put a hat over Joey's ears to keep off the sun. I've heard of a place where I can get fresh vegetables cheaper. We'll drive over and look at them. Joey was pleased to be having an adventure. In spite of the heat, he trotted along briskly in the direction that Mr. Pulaski told him was New Jersey. Finally, he trotted up a sort of a hill and all of a sudden found himself on a great bridge flung across the water. There seemed to be a big crowd gathered there, and the cars were moving slowly. Joey hurried a little so he could see what was going on. but the rest of the traffic was so slow he finally had to stop. While he and Mr. Pulaski were wondering why the cars and trucks were all coming to a standstill, a man with a red carnation in his buttonhole stepped up to them. He wore a silk hat and carried a bouquet of flowers. Behind him came several other men, some with cameras, some with pencils and papers. "Congratulations," said the man with the silk hat. "These flowers are for you. You have also won a $50 prize. What is your name, sir?" "Pulaski," the cart driver said, much surprised. "Please, I don't understand." "We are from the Department of Bridges," the man said, "and this prize goes to the millionth vehicle to pass the end of the bridge. Your cart was the millionth." "We're reporters," said one of the men carrying pencil and paper. "There's quite a story here for our papers. You see, we had expected a car or a truck or a bus to get the award. We didn't count on a horse and cart." "What's your horse's name?" asked another reporter. And when Mr. Pulaski told him, he wrote down Joey. Then he shook hands with Mr. Pulaski, and several people cheered. It was almost as good as leading a parade. The first man put the flowers in front of the cart and handed Mr. Pulaski $5 $10 bills. Then the men with the cameras crowded around, and cars stopped to watch, and people shouted cheerful remarks. "Smile now," said a cameraman, "and hold on to your horse. We especially want a good shot of him." "That's quite a bonnet he's wearing," said another, "but he needs just one more touch. He's the hero of the day, you know." He whispered something to the man in the silk hat. Then that gentleman took the red carnation out of his buttonhole and tucked it behind Joey's ear. "Now don't let him move," said the cameraman. But Joey wouldn't have moved for anything. He stood still as a statue and looked straight into the camera. Afterwards, the reporters patted his neck and complimented Mr. Pulaski on driving such a well-behaved horse. The silk-hatted man said, "We're holding up traffic, I'm afraid. You'll have to move on. But look in the papers tomorrow. You'll be sure to see yourself." When they got back to the stable that night, Joey didn't say a word to the other horses about his adventure. Something might go wrong. Maybe the papers wouldn't use the picture after all. Besides, he was afraid his hat wasn't really becoming. Next morning, Mr. Pulaski burst in, waving half a dozen newspapers. "Look, Joey," he cried, "here we are. We're famous." He opened one of the papers, and there, almost on the front page, was a picture of Joey, handsome as a circus horse, with his hat becomingly tilted and the red carnation behind his ear. Underneath the picture it said, "New York, only one horse town after all. Cart horse Joey wins $50 prize." All the horses craned their necks over the stalls to see. Even Brownie was impressed. "But that's not all, Joey. Maybe a vegetable cart is a gold mine after all. A friend of mine saw that picture and telephoned me right away. He's got a farm in the country, and he needs somebody to help him in the city. He'll bring me fresh vegetables every day, and you and I will sell them. Now I won't mind if my 6 children grow so fast out of their shoes." My, but Joey was happy. He said later to the percheron, "It would have been nice to have been a real hero, but I expect this is nearly as good. Anyhow, I got Mr. Pulaski his promotion."
Hooray for Joey, and goodbye to you until next week. Stories Are for Fun is presented by Radio Television, the University of Texas, in cooperation with the Austin Junior League and the Austin Public Schools. The stories are prepared for broadcast by Jane Rowley and Darcy Norris and directed by Blair Wilkins. The Horse Who Had His Picture in the Paper is written by Phyllis McGinley and published by J.B. Lippincott Company. Permission to use the story granted by Curtis Brown Limited. This is Jim Morris speaking, transcribed from the University of Texas.
Being a Lux girl, Jean depended on a quick beauty pickup. A refreshing Lux soap beauty bath did the trick, she told me.
Now that their beauty soap is in big new bath size, a Lux soap bath is more luxurious than ever.
Well, I can't imagine a nicer bath soap, John. Wonderful creamy lather, even in hard water. And a lovely, delicate fragrance that lasts and lasts.
The Lux soap perfume is an exclusive blend, you know. It combines lily of the valley, lilac, carnation, and other delicate flower fragrances.
I'm sure every woman who tries the big new bath-size Lux toilet soap will love it.
Yes, that generous satin smooth bath cake is a good item to put at the head of your shopping list. Why not try the new bath size Lux toilet soap tomorrow? It's another fine product of Lieber Brothers Company.
Oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in, just turn me loose. Let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western sky. On my cayuse, let me wander over yonder till I see the mountains rise. I want to ride to the ridge where the west commences, gaze at the moon till I lose my senses. Can't look at hobbles and I can't stand fences. Don't fence me in. Just turn me loose, let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western skies. On my cayuse, let me wander over yonder till I see the mountains rise. I want to ride to the ridge where the west commences, gaze at the moon till I lose my senses. Can't look at hobbles and I can't stand fences. Don't fence me in.
Straighten out, steady. Lord Basil, won't you behave? They're off, and they got away, and there was a bumping match right at the start, and Lord Basil got clear, but he didn't get clear. No. Yes, he is. Now he's clear. He's all right. And he's on the inside, and Knockdown is right beside him. And they're going to come by the stand here with Lord Bothwell. And Spy Song has stepped by him, and now Spy Song is on the lead. It is Spy Song coming to the stand in the lead by a length and a half. And it is Knockdown in second place. Rippy is fighting for third. And on the inside, Dark Jungle got through on the inside and is third. Spy Song is cutting out the pace around the turn by a length and a half, with Knockdown second and Dark Jungle third. Rippy is fourth, Assault is fifth, Hampton is sixth and can't get going. And on the outside, it is now We Admiral moving up very strongly and going up to sixth place, and they're straightening into the backstretch. Spy Song is sailing along a length and a half in front. Johnny Longdon sitting very quiet. And on the inside, Dark Jungle, a long shot, is running a surprising race. Assault on the inside is look out, you're in tight quarters, boy. But he's going to get pinched back. Spy Song is still out there by a length and a half. And Big Knockdown is not giving him any chance to get away. He's hanging right to him. And they're going into the far turn. And now Knockdown is asking Spy Song to race. And on the outside, Hampton is moving very fast and going up there challenging for the position. Assault is on the inside in fourth place. And it looks like they're going to fight it out. Alamond is coming up from the rear. Out and now, it is still Spy Song, and Knockdown is coming at him. They're coming to the mile post. They're at the mile, right back where they started. Spy Song is still there, fighting gamely by a length and a half. It looks like Assault will be the horse to beat down the stretch. He's holding ground on the inside, but driving hard. It's anybody's race. Assault cut that last corner and got through on the inside, and is up to Spy Song, and in front, Assault is pulling away and leading now by two lengths with a tremendous burst of speed. Knockdown is hanging, and Spy Song is hanging on gamely, and coming through behind Spy Song is Lord Boswell, but too late. And the winner, galloping as he pleases by very close to seven lengths, is Assault. In second place, Spy Song. Hampton finished on the outside to get third place. Lord Boswell was fourth. Knockdown was fifth. Alamon was sixth. Dark Jungle was seventh. Bob Murphy was eighth. And the last horse to finish, as you might expect, was Kendar.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio. Clint McCarthy with the call of the 1946 Kentucky Derby, broadcast on WHAS on May 6, 1946. We also heard Gene Autry with the Cole Porter composition, Don't Fence Me In, from 1944. And Colleen Hardin read a story on Stories Are for Fun. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s, when the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Right now, Wendell Corey stars of The Adventures of Steve Canyon as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Okay, clear number three engine. Takeoff time for Steve Canyon, colorful hero of Milton Caniff's exciting newspaper adventure strip. Brought to the air by Canyon's wartime flying buddy, the gallant leader of America's first flying commando unit in Burma, the original Flip Corkin himself, Colonel Philip G. Cochran. This is Phil Cochran. You know, a guy doesn't bring many good things out of a war. But one good thing I was lucky enough to hang on to was the friendship of a lean, rangy rascal named Steve Canyon. When the powers that be stopped World War II, somehow they just plumb forgot to turn off old Steve. He's still out there, flying all over in a big surplus C-54. His destination? The nearest available dollar. And the dollars have been coming few and far between. Well, maybe he's not the world's best businessman, but he sure is a good correspondent. He loves to write. I get a letter from him every week. And this being another week, here's another letter. Postmark, August 27, Rangoon, Burma. It starts, Dear Phil, remember the first time you and I passed through here in 41 on our way up to join Wingate? Things got hot that night, too. But Flyboy, you should have been in
on this junket. We came down empty across the Bay of Bengal from Calcutta. Picked up the coast at dusk when that big Burmese sun was starting to sink below our left wingtip. We dropped the 1,500 feet as he swung in over the 6 miles of the Irrawaddy River. And just seeing it, I could remember the stench of those Oriental deltas. Believe it or not, one of my engines coughed a little. And I didn't blame it out there in that air. And the city was still the same, crowded and bustling with movement, most of it concerned with lugging some load on some back from some place to some other. I spent the first evening with my co-pilot, Breck Nazaire, in a joint called the Bloody Mary, and the natives went all out in giving us a rousing welcome.
Hey, but one left, and I got... fast, Stevie, sir. This place looks about poured out.
Yeah. Kick a path to the door and let's get out of here before they start licking our hands.
Certainly.
And by the way, why did I have to pick a co-pilot like you? You get into more saloon fights than a bouncer. In Shanghai, Hong Kong, Singapore, Darwin, Penang. And now you're acting like the Robert E. Lee of Rangoon.
Now, Stevie, sir, you cut that out. It's downright sacrilegious. Anyway, I was in here working.
Nice work.
But I was. I swear I was.
Uh-huh.
I was standing at the bar alone talking to a little old girl on my right, and this here other little old girl, she come up on my left and just tap me on the shoulder.
Uh-huh. So little old girls are chasing you for a change.
She were looking for you, son. She got a payload for Horizons Unlimited. Well, sir, we were talking just as nice as you could please, and some big, fat scoundrel, without any nose to his face at all, come up and started pushing around.
So you opened up, huh?
Well, certainly I did. I gave him a burst where that visa should have been, and then it turned out he brought some friends with him, and, well, bless you, old true-in-law. I certainly am glad you showed up.
Yeah. And what happened to Miss Payload of 1948? Did she fade out with your fat friend?
I wish I knew.
Well, we sure could have used that money.
Mm-mm. I sure could have used that honey.
Here we go again. Breck, you're the doggone... Breck.
Huh?
Hold it.
What?
Unidentified craft doorway, 2 o'clock.
Huh? Why, looky!
Hey, Breck!
It's her, Stevie. Come in. Well, miss, it certainly is good to see you again. You, my dear, are about to preserve the honor of a son of the old South.
Please, get in here out of the light.
Well... This is cozy. Breck, I'm surprised at you. Big boys don't cuddle in hallways.
Quiet, you fool. Come in here, both of you. He's still following me.
Well, faint heart, never won fair payload. Lead on. Ah, so this is the belle of the brawl. Breck, I think it'd be right nice if I got to meet the lady for whom my nose so recently was pummeled.
Why, sure. Steve Canyon, it does me proud to be able to introduce our new business associate, Miss Honor Bright.
Huh? Would you mind repeating that?
Honor Bright. What's the matter? Don't you like my name?
I liked it. And I liked the way she said it. I've never been so close to a woman I've known for so short a time. The hallway was that small. But don't get me wrong, Phil. I didn't mind. She had everything, that gal, and a white linen dress that pointed up. Even the moon was working for her. Came sneaking in through the grill work in the door... And you should have seen how her face lit up that moonbeam. And something else I always admire in a woman, Phil. She was pretty flip with her lip.
Mr. Canyon, if you can get your mind off what I think you've got it on, I'd like to talk business with you. I'm in trouble and I'd like to cut you in.
Thanks a lot.
Listen, you have an airplane and I have a problem. I'll pay a lot of money.
Well, the lady says money.
That's the magic word. Where do we go and when do we start?
Shimbuyang tonight.
Shimbuyang? That's 1,000 miles.
That's my problem.
Shimbuyang. That is a problem. That strip is about the size of a doormat, and it doesn't spell welcome.
That we can take care of. But one thing I gotta know. Is this deal legal?
It's legal. Have you heard of the ruby mines of Tali?
Yeah, I know where they are. It's your business, but if you're interested in rubies, why don't you look up a nice, quiet credit jeweler?
Mr. Canyon, smart men don't make smart cracks.
Sorry.
Well, this is it. My father was the general manager of the Tali Mining Company before the war. He died in a Japanese concentration camp. He was tortured to death and burned.
No.
Because he wouldn't give up the thing he loved most, rubies. By the time he was captured by the Japanese, he'd collected a fortune in rubies. That's what they were after. But he died before he'd tell them where they were.
And, ma'am, you do know?
No, not yet. But there's a man in Shimbuyang waiting to tell me. He was my father's best friend, Robert Chandler.
Uh-huh.
Mr. Chandler buried my father's ashes at the entrance of the Tali mine. I just received another letter from him telling me to come and get the rubies.
Well, that sounds simple enough.
Yes, it was. Until I went back to my hotel room after dinner tonight. My room had been torn to pieces and Robert Chandler's letter had been stolen. That's when I came looking for you.
Well, never let it be said that a canyon was found and found wanting. Breck, where's the crew?
Well, Mudder's probably somewhere playing the horses. Two-Way's probably somewhere playing the radio. And Rugg and the rest are certainly in that boarding house just plain.
Get them. Miss Bright and I will meet you at the ship.
Oh, Captain, my Captain, the assignments you do give me.
you are, sir. Genuine London cab. Finest ride in Rangoon.
Hey, can your horse make it to the airport?
Right, sir. And quick as a flash to boot. Mind the step, lady.
I will.
No matter what you say, the horse will never replace the airplane.
On your way now. Get up.
Okay, Miss Bright, let's talk.
Okay. I know who stole that letter.
Pardon me for asking, Governor. Are you one of them flying chaps? You've got the look about you, you have.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I wish I could pack this old blooming bundle in a flying machine and go breezing home to dear old London.
What's the matter? Don't you like it?
Like it? I hate it, I do. There I was, 20 years ago, minding my own business, and somebody has to go and give me a book of poems. Rudyard Kipling. I'd like to have him here right now. I'd Rudyard him, I would.
Yeah. Now, Miss Bright...
Where the dawn comes up like thunder out of China, course, what bay? Come on, get up, Kipling. You and your blooming poems.
Now, Miss Bright, as you were saying, about that letter.
Well, I know who stole it. The same man who told the Japs about my father's rubies. The same man who helped them kill him. The same man you fought in the saloon tonight.
You mean the little fat...
Yes, the little fat man with no nose.
Yeah, my nose would feel better if he had no muscle.
And now he's trying to keep me from getting the fortune that's rightfully mine.
Well, I'm a guy who thinks that every dame should have a fortune. Which reminds me, do you know how much a trip like this costs?
I don't care.
I'd better tell you. We've got a lot of engines and a lot of men. We charge $4 American per mile. That includes our flying, our feeding, and our fighting.
I said I don't care.
In advance.
I've got the money with me, if you don't mind traveler's checks.
Love them.
Fine. Now, can we please hurry?
What are we waiting for? Cabby, give it the gun.
What's that, Governor?
Keep him moving. Turn on more speed.
Speed, speed. Everybody who goes to the aerodrome wants speed. First it's that other fella, and now it's you. This ain't no blooming flying machine.
Did I hear you say other fella? What other fella?
Me last fare, just before I picked up you two. He was an ugly little chap. Looked like a fat frog, he did. Here, you won't believe this. He didn't have a speck of a nose on his face.
When we hit the field, I went into what they called an operations office. They said they didn't know whether any plane had checked out for Shimbu Yang. So I didn't bother telling them that we were. A lullaby that monotony sings to you when you're flying over 1,000 miles of peaceful, soggy jungle. But the way it worked out, Breck was doing the sleeping, I was doing the flying. We made Mishinaw and Dawn at about the same time, and an hour later we dropped over the hills that hide Shimbu Yang. I tipped the ship over into gentle bank, cut back my power, and started to let down. I used my foot for an alarm clock. But it was the sight of that strip that really woke my ever-loving co-pilot.
Stevie! Holy mackerel, is this Shimbu Yang?
It ain't Columbus, Ohio.
Ouch, Daddy, that strip is smaller than my ex-wife's heart.
I hope it's softer in case we do pile up. Give me quarter flaps.
Quarter flaps? Stevie, so putting this size ship into that size runway would discourage a fit in a lady's shoe store.
Give me some wheels.
Wheels coming down.
Okay, I got a roller.
I got a roller. Nose wheel down.
Props, 2,500.
All ready?
Yeah. Full flaps.
Oh, Stevie, don't you waste an inch. Look out, little strip. We're going to hit you right on your lip. And we did it!
We didn't scare the pants off our lady passenger. I'm going back to see if she needs any first aid.
All right. Pappy, I always say there's a better place for women than airplanes. Hope she didn't get too sick.
Good Lord, she fainted. Well, how do you like that? Hey, Sleeping Beauty, wake up. Mm-hmm. Watching those eyes open was like watching the morning sun snuggling its way out from under the covers of a bed of clouds when you're flying at 20,000. But when that gal woke up, she wasn't interested in romance. She was interested in rubies. I told the crew to break out the sidearms and the ladder. Phil, what would you think if you landed on a jungle strip and were not immediately surrounded by a swarm of natives? That's what we thought. So Breck and I left the crew to guard the ship. We knew something was wrong. We found out just how wrong when we walked through the door of Mr. Chandler's office at the Tally Mining Company. He was sitting at his desk, but he didn't give us a cordial greeting. He couldn't.
Oh. Ooh, I wouldn't want to be alive and look that way.
Oh. What did they do to him?
It looks like they worked him over with a meat grinder.
The natives?
No, they do cleaner work. This man's been tortured. You know what that means.
It means somebody want to know something he knew, and they must have wanted it awful bad.
Steve, what am I going to do? This is the only man who could tell me where I can find my rubies. The only man who knew.
I'll interrupt your mourning for the late Mr. Chandler just long enough to tell you you're probably wrong. From the looks of things, I'd say by now, somebody else knows. Phil, to continue this little travel folder on the charms and beauty of Shimbuyang. There we were, sitting on the tag end of a 1,000-mile flight, looking a dead man and a lot of trouble square in the face. Outside in the hills, the natives were wailing. Inside, my nerve ends were doing the same thing. I took another look at Miss Honor Bright. Being in the same room with a fresh corpse didn't seem to throw her. She was cool as ice. And just for a moment, I thought what a pleasant job it would be trying to defrost her. Just about then, I got a chill all my own. A nice, cold gun muzzle right at the base of my neck.
Don't move.
Don't worry.
Hey, what is this?
Silent! Stay right where you are. Now, three of you, move forward until you reach the desk. Quickly! Now, you may turn around.
You.
Well, as I live and breathe, if it isn't old no-nose.
Quiet, you swine.
Well, look at who's calling who a pig. I'd hate to leave you alone with a good full garbage can.
Breck. What do you want with us?
Miss Bright, unbuckle their gun belts. Let them drop to the floor.
What?
Move!
Is this what they call a disarming manner?
No. You ask me what I want. Miss Bright knows what I want from her. You will fly me out of here when I get it.
Oh? Well, if I'm a-going flying, let's go. Hey, Stevie, tight turn. May day. Check.
Loud and clear. Now listen, Miss Honor Bright.
Me? What have I done?
I'll show you what you've done.
Hey, stop! Stop, you two!
I know what you're up to, you...
No! Come on!
When Breck said tight turn and May Day, it meant only two things to me. To give him some evasive action and stand by for a crash. Slapping a lady in the kisser was the most evasive action I could think of. But then, brother, did old Breck go crashing through that window. Our friend with no nose snapped a few shots after him, but that only made Breck go faster. I made a move to my gun, but Flat Face stopped that with a quick move from his.
Don't move!
Can't you think of anything else to say?
Steve Canyon, I'll pay you back for that, you brute.
Shut up.
You're in a rut, you know that?
Your friend thought he was smart, but he was stupid, Canyon. He might have caused me to kill you both.
Pretty boy. You need us, remember?
That is why you are still alive. Furthermore, your friend will do no shooting at me as long as I have you. Come, both of you, out of here.
Pretty Boys 45 was directing the show. So we took our cue and trotted out like nice little people.
I could hear one good reason why he wanted to pull a fast fade out. From the sound of their wails, I could tell the natives were coming down out of the hills. Some blood had been spilled, and they were out to mop up on the guy who spilled it. One look at Pretty Boy's face would have convinced any jury he was the guilty party. We ran across the clearing into one of the couple of native huts near the entrance of the Tally Mine.
No, Miss Bright. I have to get out of here quickly. So I make you proposition. You want your rubies. I want your rubies. Neither one of us get them without the other.
Don't listen to this hoghead.
You stay out of this, you woman hater.
Save your talk. Keep your hands up. Well, Miss Bright.
What do you know that I don't know?
I know this. Your rubies are buried in your father's ashes.
The rubies buried in my father's ashes? I don't believe it.
You believe Chandler? And I squeezed that much from his weak lips just before he died. Now, about what you know that I do not know. You know where your father is buried. Come now, we go, quickly.
Do you think I'd take you to where he's buried? To have you paw through his ashes?
I think you will if you do not want to die. I'm not going to wait long for you to make up your foolish mind.
You know what I think, Pretty Boy?
Shut up.
I think you'd better get your track shoes on. Take a look, here they come.
What are we going to do?
We will be killed.
Listen, Pretty Boy, if you'll let me take my hands down and give me one of your guns, we may be able to scrape out of this. Our only chance is using crossfire. If you'll hold this hut, I'll do what I can about holding the one next door. You going to give me a gun?
You will shoot me.
I should, but we can't spare you right now. How about it?
But the rubies.
Are you out of your mind? Give him a gun.
All right. If I must, here.
Come on, Arnie, you're coming with me.
No, she's staying here.
Not while I've got a gun. Come on. No sooner than Arnie and I made the other hut than our well-planned defense fell to pieces. Converging crossfire may be all right when you're shooting it out with barefooted infantry, but we suddenly found ourselves up against an armored attack. Heading the column was that big D-4 surplus army bulldozer, lumbering across the clearing straight at our huts. I could see the blade coming up as they raised the shield of good Pennsylvania steel with which to play patty cake with our bullets. I told Honor to stand in close to me. I figured I might as well die warm.
I hope my shivering doesn't shake your aim.
Honey, shooting at that thing with this pop gun, it ain't going to make a better difference. Hey, put your head over here for a minute.
What are you going to do, slap me again?
Not exactly. There.
Well, this is a fine time to start that.
In about a half a second, it's going to be a fine time to start shooting. As they say in the Army, keep your shoulders down, kid. Oh, there goes Gun Happy. He couldn't hold his fire.
Oh, Steve, do you think we've got a chance?
What do you think? We've only got 7 bullets.
Oh.
No use wasting them on that dozer blade. If Pretty Boy fire keeps him heading for his hut, maybe I can pop off that driver. Here he comes. A little more. There, he's almost cradled in my sights. Just a little more, and we'll rock him to sleep.
Steve, listen.
What is it? Stand back, baby. That's the southern arrangement of the battle cry of freedom. I greeted that ironclad jukebox with a 7-shot salute straight through the roof over my head. It seemed like that old bulldozer thanked me with a little more speed. She squared off and settled into her run. She went walking right into Pretty Boy's hut. And when she knocked on the door, she knocked it down, wall and all. When she went crunching through the front, old Pretty Boy went scrambling out the back.
There he goes!
Steve, the natives, they're after him.
After him. They got him.
Hey! Beavis, you all right?
Yeah, Brick.
Oh, wait a minute before he gets here. Put your head over here for a minute.
What do you want? Hey, what's the big idea?
Hey, that's a good idea.
Oh, Captain Canyon, you're wonderful. Thanks.
Well, how do you like that? I go to all the trouble of rounding up the crew, the natives, that bulldozer, and even playing my national anthem on the harmonica to rescue the lady. Who does she thank? The innocent bystander.
We
gave her 20 minutes to go get her rubies. What she was going to do, I didn't want to watch. She was back in 15, and we didn't lose a second putting a mess of clean air between us and the shambles of Shimbuyang. I let Miss Honor Bright stand between Breck and me during the takeoff without benefit of seatbelt. Never having been an admirer of grave robbers, I figured if she sat down hard in a hurry, she could use a spanking.
Subway straps up here, Captain.
Ha ha, very funny.
I might have hurt myself.
Not if the rest of you is as hard as your heart.
And just what do you mean by that?
I hope you didn't dirty your hands digging up your precious rubies.
I didn't.
I suppose you got them in a good safe place.
I have.
Where are they?
Where they belong, Captain Canyon. They're with my father. I didn't have the heart to go through with it.
Hey, wait a minute. I guess I had you wrong. Miss Bright, you may not know it, but you just pushed human nature's stock up about 20 points in my market. For a while there, I thought the soft spot in your heart was for nothing but rubies.
Thanks a million.
Oh! Stevie, the lady opened her mouth and you put your big fat foot right in it.
I was right. She blew up like a $4 firecracker.
Well, I reckon I'd be a mite jumpy, too, if I'd have come all the way out here to Shimbuyang, spent all that money, then find myself going back empty-handed.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of it that way. You know, Breck, this money she paid us is probably just about all she had in the world. Without those rubies, she probably needs it.
Now, Stevie, if I was your business manager, I would right now stuff a great big hanky in your mouth.
You know, if we gave half of it back, we'd still break even.
Pappy, you're talking like a man who's in a hurry to go broke.
Here, take the ship. I'm going to see that poor kid and give her half her money back.
Oh.
Miss Bright.
Oh.
I want to talk to you. Mind if I sit down?
No, I suppose not. Careful!
I darn near crash landed on this pretty little purse of yours.
Give me that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, Miss Bright, I'd hate to get you wrong again.
Oh.
Of course, it may turn out that you're on your way to a marble tournament, and those things rolling around the floor are your pretty red Aggies.
It's none of your business. Those rubies are mine. Now, what did you want to talk to me about?
Only this. Breck and I were figuring things out. We find we've made a mistake in the amount of money we charge you for this trip. You owe us another $1,000. I sure do pity the unlucky rube who winds up with that dame and her unlucky rubies. Oh, too bad she wasn't as soft as her curves. She took the next boat out of Rangoon for the States. We took a dull load of freight out to Hanoi. Truck tires and machinery. Not a kiss in a carload. We hit our checkpoint on the Salween River at 1000, set our engines at cruising RPM, and settled down for the long haul over the Thailand Hills. Hey, Breck, what are you doing there?
Oh, I'm riding in the log.
You must be writing a novel.
No, just entering our last payload.
What's it say?
You're gonna love this one, Steve. It's one of my best. Quote. Once was a gal from Rangoon who we flew neath the old Burmese moon. I hoped for romancing, but we all wound up dancing a waltz with a no-nose baboon.
Unquote and out, Junior.
But we all wound up dancing a waltz with a no-nose baboon. And that'll give you an idea, Phil, of how things have calmed down in this theater of war since it became a theater of peace. I didn't make up a word of it. Honor Bright. Pass this letter around to any of my friends you might bump into, and I'll be shooting you another one next week. As usual, Steve Canyon. Well, that's it. There's no telling what postmark next week's letter from Steve will be wearing. With that guy, it might be Karachi or Kansas City. One thing we do know, it'll be a half hour long. Rendezvous point for next week is this same time, this same station. Until then, this is Phil Cochran saying goodnight to you. And to Steve Canyon out there, wherever you are, long runways and happy landing.
CBS has presented Wendell Corey as Steve Canyon, colorful hero of Milton Caniff's exciting newspaper adventure strip, brought to the air by Canyon's wartime flying buddy, the gallant leader of America's first flying commando unit in Burma, Colonel Philip Flip Cochran. Tony Barrett plays Freck, music scored and conducted by Richard Arant. Steve Canyon is written and produced in radio color by Paul Dudley, Gil Dowd, and James Burton, with special effects and technical advice by the United States Air Force. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The Golden Age of Radio on WMKY with an episode of Steve Canyon starring Wendell Corey. This has been the Golden Age of Radio, classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows, on the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at this same time and channel, on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.